This is so ghetto. Cara Santa Maria is here, ladies and gentlemen. My friend, Brian's friend, Jamie knows her. But we'll all be friends eventually. What's up? How are you? Good to
I'm
see
good.
You.
How are you?
What's cracking? Oh, there we go.
There.
You did
all
it.
Right. I'm trying to tell my Facebook followers that I'm on right now, but there's so many different Joe Rogans, and I don't want to click on the wrong one. Which one is you?
Joe Rogan, DOTNET.
What the fuck?
.net.
No, but like on your Facebook, which one is your actual, or are these all just people trying to
mostly
be
they're not me. There's like 100 fake me's
all
out
right
there.
So I may be tagging fake Joe Rogan right now.
If someone's sending you some dick pics, guarantee you that's not me.
All right,
guarantee
good to know.
You good it's to not, know. Even it looks exactly like my dick, that's not me. Tell you right now, I have the sweet Talk Nerdy t-shirt on right now, which represents Cara Santa Maria's awesome podcast. How many episodes do you have now?
I just put up episode 26.
Jesus Louises.
Can you believe that?
And was I on number one?
You were number one. Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
And I do it weekly. And you inspired me. You and your listeners inspired me to do this.
Well, you're born for this. This is a perfect venue for you.
I'm telling you, thank you, by the way, but I'm telling you, when I left your studio the last time I was on, I probably got 300 tweets from people saying, start your podcast,
start your podcast, that's
we'll
awesome.
Listen.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and it was great. It was so great.
That's so cool that you already have 26 of them. That's incredible.
Yeah.
How did you do that so fast?
I just do them weekly, and it's been that long.
It's been 26 weeks?
Yeah.
So it's been 6 months, essentially?
Yeah, I started in like March or April.
Wow.
Whatever that was.
That's awesome, though. Yeah. That's so cool that you did it. You need something like this because, you know, whenever you deal with a lot of producers or, you know, network folk, they mean well, but everyone has their own idea of what should happen. And even if they're nice people, it gets in the way.
It's so true. And like, right now I contribute to two different television shows and I'm very lucky. I'm a freelancer. I'm a contributor. So I work on a show on Al Jazeera America called Techno, which is a great science kind of news magazine style show. And then I work on a local show here in LA called SoCal Connected, which is on KCET, which used to be our PBS affiliate. And now it's just a public television kind of standalone. And that's great. I have great producers. I get to self-produce some stuff. It's wonderful. Prior to only doing those and the podcast, I was full-time on a show called Take Part Live on Pivot TV. That was daily 8 to 12 hours a day, every day, you know, hair and makeup for 2 hours straight. Basically,
2 hours?
Yeah.
Were they trying to turn you into a werewolf?
Insane. Absolutely
the fuck
insane.
Is that?
Yeah.
2 hours.
Didn't look like, wasn't allowed to wear my hair straight, wasn't allowed to wear black, wasn't allowed. It was crazy. Like, I couldn't.
They had rules?
Very strict. I could not be myself on that show. And I look back, and that is really when the podcast started because I was so, like you said, kind of boxed into speaking only in sound bites and presenting a version of myself that honestly, I was not comfortable really presenting. The podcast was a really, really necessary outlet. Like, it was so psychologically freeing for me. And now I think it really helps keep me centered and anchored when I do new jobs and new work to really understand how not to let things get out of hand like that.
Yeah, the best representative of yourself is yourself.
Yeah,
and
totally.
When you got a bunch of people, like, deciding what you should do, I think you'd be great if you wore pink. You look like you should be in pink.
That legitimate, like I did. They made me wear pink. Like it was crazy. And I had to wear my hair all curly. I had it dyed
Why
red
curly?
And they hated that. And I don't know, man. It's like, I think it's because I was the only girl on the show. At the time, it was like very male heavy. And I was supposed to be like the representative of the female species, which was like, come on. I'm kind of a tomboy. Like it wasn't really working for me. It was a lot of short skirts too, which it's just weird for me. Like I like to wear black leather.
Whoa.
Ooh. But yeah,
short skirts
they
are weird
that.
Anyway. And we've talked about it many times in the podcast about how you watch Fox News and all those women who, like, it's almost like they have it in their contract that they have to uncross and cross their legs like a certain amount of times per minute.
Yep.
Because it's like, who the fuck is that uncomfortable that you're constantly shifting and switching your legs back and forth? And if a man dressed like that, it would be so insane.
Oh, can you imagine?
It's insane.
Because there are, you know, if you watch runway shows ever, or you keep up with fashion at all, there are kind of male versions of that sort of ensemble, but nobody actually wears that in real life. Like the short, kind of tight, maybe not up to your nutsack, but like halfway down your thigh, these little like plaid shorts and the cute little, you know, it's very runway.
But even those are shorts.
Yeah.
There's something crazy about a skirt.
Yeah, I agree. I mean,
it's just like easy access. It's the most ridiculous invention. It's like your vagina, which is your coveted sexual organ. I mean, this is where the babies come out. This is where you let the loved ones in. There's so much to the vagina, and yet it's there protected by the thinnest piece of fabric.
If it's so even ridiculous. Is. We've seen all these little teeny bopper celebrities and their little whoopsies getting in and out of cars.
Whoopsies where there just happen to be cameras right down near their vaginas. Like, that's not a whoopsie. That shit was engineered.
And what's the reasoning behind that?
I mean, the cooter.
Why would you want to do that?
Some people want to look at it.
I don't want that.
Anthony Clark, Anthony Clark, the stand-up comedian, I'll never forget what he said about vaginas, because he's of a different persuasion. He goes, first time I saw a vagina, I was like, ew, when's it going to heal? But then it is a weird thing. I mean, that you're presented as a serious journalist on Fox News or as a neuroscientist, mm-hmm. which is what you are, and yet they want you to have your vagina basically just barely protected by a little like napkin that they throw over it.
It's no thank you. And always the cameras are, you know, right at the midline.
Of course.
They're at the midline of the table. And mm-hmm. so it's just like an unflatter or ultra flattering, depending on how you look at it, angle that just makes you feel really exposed. It's, yeah. How are you supposed to take somebody seriously?
Well, like not only that, it doesn't make you any hotter. That's
no,
where people are confused.
You don't have to do that. Yeah. You don't have to. Like, I think it's a little better sometimes to leave things up to the imagination.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, it's not. It's definitely better to be naked. But I'm saying, like, if you're
maybe not on TV, on the news.
Well, it's
maybe
like, what
not
are you,
naked news.
What's your objective? I mean, is it better in real life? Well, no. Well, I don't know. Depends on what you're trying to do. But if you're on a show where you're just trying to, like, talk about issues, it's distracting.
Yeah.
You know, it's distracting to have, like, this really sexy outfit on. And I think that's half the reason why these, like, Fox News type shows do that. Barbara Walters never dressed like that.
No. Katie Couric did, but she, you know, not too scandalous, but she did wear short skirts. And I was actually just watching, so I'm going to get a little more comfortable. I'm very short, and I feel tiny in this chair.
Hmm.
So I'm just crossing my legs. All right. So I was watching this documentary called Misrepresentation. Have you seen this?
No.
I'm about to get like super feminist on the
show
now.
Please
really
do.
Early, just
Please
so I
do.
Can piss off like everybody on Twitter. It's actually a really good documentary. It's called Misrepresentation. You can find it on Netflix. And it was produced and kind of narrated by Jennifer Siebel Newsom, who's Gavin Newsom's wife. And the whole thing is kind of about media representations of women, how women are portrayed, how women, you know, make up X amount of the population, X amount of the jobs in this field, in this field, in this field, and then how they're represented both in fictional television but also in nonfiction programming. And they talk a little bit about that, kind of why are female news readers meant to look so sexy. It's always kind of like the crusty old dude and then like his hot niece. Like that's what it looks like when you look at a news reading team. And they have these great interviews with people like Lisa Ling and Katie Couric and kind of talking about Katie actually is very open and says, I kind of feel guilty, like almost I played into this, like maybe I set this trend in motion. And you know, I was fit, I wore, you know, not ridiculously short skirts, but you could see my legs on TV, and then it seems like that's now the formula that every news reader has to have.
Hmm.
And you almost just assume that they're dumb. Like it portrays, I don't think it portrays strength, unfortunately, when you have these like girls that or women that look like they're trying so hard to be sexy, then all of a sudden it puts it in your head like, oh, she's just reading a script that somebody else wrote for her. When sometimes these are really, really bright, really successful women. Like, why do we...
Yeah, well, I guess they just want people to watch it, and they just feel like the best way to hook people is sex.
Yeah, and the truth is they also, in the documentary, they showed all of the major news corporations, which there aren't that many anymore. You know, they've been kind of conglomerating, and more and more of the property is owned by less and less people. And they showed the number of women on the board on the board of all of these different news organizations. And so you look at like Time Warner or you look at Viacom and it's like one woman, two women, you know, two women. And as opposed to like 30 men or 15 men, the people that are making the shows and the people who have ultimate control over those kinds of decisions historically and to this day are like 99% male.
I wonder if that's why, like, women like Megyn Kelly, that Fox lady, who's not dumb at all. Mm-mm. She's very sharp.
Yeah.
But she's also kind of mean.
Yeah.
Kind of got an edge to her. I wonder if it's, like, to, like, let you know, hey, fuckface, just because I've got my tits hanging out and my legs are crisscrossed, barely covering my cooter, I'll still put you in your place.
Yeah,
like, I wonder
I think
if she feels like she has
to
be on her... She's on her heels all the time, like, always backed up.
Yeah, I don't think it's an uncommon feeling for women who are just in a position where they're surrounded by men who just are going to assume when they walk in the door that she's just dumb bimbo, she's a weather girl, she's a newsreader, but really she's writing her own copy and doing her own research and is a really strong, smart... I mean, I disagree with, like, fucking everything she says, but I've seen her be a total brilliant shark on air before.
Mm-hmm.
She's slightly more rational than most of the people on that network. That's not saying much.
Yeah, she can be pretty rational, but she, you know, she's right wing, and that's her thing.
Yeah,
you know?
And she's like a real right wing.
Yeah, Santa Claus is white.
Yeah.
Okay, is that her? Mm-hmm. Kapow! She's hot as fuck. That's very distracting, right? It is, but it's also.
I don't think she usually looks like that on air.
That's what she should do. Just fucking work it all the way.
Terrible
be
idea.
Ridiculous. She should do the news from a bed. All the news should be done from silk sheets. Yeah, look
there
at
you
that.
Go.
She's got her tits highlighted.
Yeah.
She does.
They're different colored.
Yeah,
that's an interesting.
I mean, come on. Those
interesting
are,
wardrobe choice.
She basically has a two-tone thing with the tits, like, impossible to not look at because they don't blend in at all.
And that's the thing. It's like they really push you. I remember on Take Part Live one day wearing one of my favorite looks, which was like black pants, high heels, a white button-down shirt that was fitted. I mean, I think that the outfit was, I'd consider it like a hot outfit, and a black tie. But I had my hair braided and kind of pulled back, and I was wearing glasses. And my producer told me that I couldn't dress like that anymore because it was too masculine.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I know.
Does he know what you look like?
I know. I'm like, I'm a girl. Like, it's obvious that I'm not trying to be a dude. I like to wear ties.
Is your producer gay?
No.
No. You don't have to say.
No, he wasn't.
It wasn't?
No.
No. Maybe he really was.
No, he wasn't.
Maybe he really was.
For sure he wasn't.
Well, if he thought you looked masculine like that.
No, I mean, I don't know. It's like, put on a short skirt. Like, and you get that thing, too, where even if they don't overtly tell you, it's like you get off air every night. And when you're dressed in an outfit that you love, like pants, a shirt, like you feel comfortable, but you feel good about yourself. And you look in the mirror and you think your body looks good. It's like, whatever. Okay, fine show, whatever. You wear like the dumbest little short pink skirt or dress that you're totally uncomfortable in and you're not acting like yourself. You look great tonight. Like in your IFB, like in your ear. It's
In your IFB,
so
in your
gross.
Ear.
Yeah, because they're constantly there, like in your ear. Like
that's gross too. Yeah. The IFBs are gross.
I know.
Those
it's horrible.
Having someone talk to you, especially if you're in the middle of a conversation and
so
they're saying,
difficult.
Get off that or don't say this or bring this back and bring up that or ask this.
It's tough. It's tough, especially when there's like tension between you and your producer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When
oh, yeah. Because
like,
then it makes
not
you
not hiding it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when I do post-fight interviews, when I first started doing it, they used to talk to me in my ear like way back in the day. Like sometimes I'd be in mid-sentence and there'd be some fucking clueless shithead on the other end. You know, it hasn't happened in decades because then the new guys are awesome. The guys that have been doing it for, you know, since, but in the 90s when I did it, like there would be a guy talking. I literally had to take the thing out of my ear because I couldn't concentrate on what I was saying.
And then they have a meltdown in the booth when they see you take it out of your ear.
They don't know what it's like. You literally can't form a sentence. First of all, when you're doing post-fight interviews, you're doing it in real time, off the cuff, completely ad-libbed, and you're asking questions and adjusting based on how the fighter talks to you.
And that's what they don't understand. Like, even a good producer will be like, well, I never talk to you while you're talking. I wait until you stop talking. It's like, yeah, but I have to fucking hear what the person I'm interviewing says to me.
Yeah, you literally can't hear them.
You
if someone's talking in your ear and you're talking, I don't hear it.
No, you can't hear it at all. And it's the same thing. That show I was on was a live show every night. So I get it. Counting down to commercial, the things where you have to keep time. Hey, guys, we got to wrap it up. We've only got a minute left. Great. But like just the talking and the talking, or you should say this. It's like, right. Fuck you. I'm not going to say that. Yeah, I'm going to say what I want to say.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about the internet. You know, the beautiful thing about the internet and producing your own show and creating your own show is I kind of look at those old shows, the shows that have been around for a long time like that, especially those news type shows where you talked about like the uncle and the niece and the, like mm-hmm. that kind of weird format where they talk fake and it's everything 7 minutes cut to commercial. I feel like that's a dinosaur. I really don't think that's going to last.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to last for people sort of our generation. I use that loosely. Mm-hmm. But I think most of Middle America is still watching that kind of traditional television.
Middle America gets the internet, too.
They do. That's true.
I think Middle America is not Middle America anymore. I think most of Middle America, I mean, they're watching what's on because it's always been there.
Because it's
there.
But people
are way more hip.
Yeah, they are.
You tell it when you go on the road. Don't you feel it, Brian, when you go like to Ohio and all these different places? Like, that used to be, like, a little behind. They're not really behind anymore. There's a lot of fucking slick people that are living in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what's great about everything. I mean, I just got rid of cable for my first time, and for once, I'm, like, choosing what I want to watch instead of just, like, oh, what's on TV right mm-hmm. now? So you're kind of directing. But are these middle America people picking out stupid shit? Like, I want to watch this and that,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Slowly but surely, though, they're getting more hip.
No, I think so too. I think part of the problem, though, is that, I mean, you look at the statistics and Fox News is still the most watched news network. Like, what does that say about our country?
Well, it says, first of all, they don't really know what the fuck people are watching because the Nielsen ratings are ridiculous.
That's true.
It's the most antiquated way of figuring out. It's the only thing that's worse is the Arbitron. When they try to figure out who's listening to radio, that shit's ridiculous.
Really?
Like, they give you a book and you're supposed to carry it around and write down when you listen to this channel, when you listen to that channel. Like, they don't fucking know.
Well, and also what ends up happening is that people represent themselves to be different than they are. They're like, I love NPR, when they, like, never listen to NPR because they think it looks good.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, there's that thing that they do on networks as well where they'll like, if you're on a talk show especially, they have the ratings based on how many people are watching up into a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's why The Tonight Show has a 20-minute first break, because 15 minutes in is when they do their first rating.
Yeah.
So they don't want to cut to commercial, because then you'll change the channel, it'll fuck up the ratings. So they have this 20-minute thing. So everything is geared towards, like, keep watching us! Look at us!
Yeah.
Ooh, 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 ooh. We're gonna do something crazy! And they just...
it's like sweeps every night.
My titties.
Yeah.
They do anything to try to get you to hang in there for 20 minutes, and then they'll bring someone on. And that's like what the skirts are all about, and that's what why you have all these people that... their sensibility is not based on what's the best way to get Kara's thoughts out. What's the best way to get Megan's thoughts out? The thing is, how do I get someone to watch this chick?
Oh, completely. And also, there is a problem, I think, where people say, okay, well, people in the industry, especially when you talk to them about this, they go, well, whatever, we just give people what they want. So you look at like bad reality TV where there's catfights and humiliation television and all the shit that, you know, the Kardashians, all the shit that we're like, ugh, it breaks my heart that this is so popular in America. And then people say, well, that's what the people want. And we're just answering to what their needs are. And, you know, we're not actually affecting any sort of social change. We're just playing into the hands of what they're interested in. But I say that that's fucking bullshit, because we have an illusion of choice in this country. Like, we don't have viable options. If I want to watch the news, I've either got Fox News, MSNBC, or CNN. Those are the things that are easy for me to find. I probably, unless I have an expanded cable package, don't have Al Jazeera or BBC World News or another
RT.
Option or RT or another option available to me. So I'm watching this programming that's no longer even news. It's just, you know, fucking advertiser blowjobs and like ratings runoffs.
Yeah. You know, RT is an interesting example.
RT is kind of a fucked up channel, though.
Yeah,
RT is very, like, in the one hand, there's amazing reporting happening there. And in mm-hmm. the other hand, it's like answers to the Kremlin.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Well, Abby Martin's a friend of mine. She's been on the mm-hmm. show several times. She's great. And she's one of the rare people that can kind of dress however she wants.
Yeah.
She dresses, she'll wear slacks, she'll wear, I mean, she's very pretty, but she'll wear... you know, she'll wear something that makes her look hot, if that's what she wants to wear,
yeah.
or she'll wear something different. But she has a weird situation there, too, where she's criticized Russia, like, especially what's going on in the Ukraine,
yeah.
and, you know, and they were like, we're going to send you to the Ukraine. And she's like, whoa, 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 the fuck you are? Like, no, you're not sending me to the Ukraine. Like, they, like, made a public, like, a press statement, because she was criticizing Putin's administration and what was going on. And, you know, it was very public on television. She did this thing. And so they said, we're going to send her to Crimea so she can see what it's like on the ground. She's like, are you out of your fucking mind?
Yeah.
I'm not going to a war zone. Like, why did you guys, you didn't talk to me? Like, you know, this is not happening. I'm just telling you right now, this is not happening, but it's weird.
It is. It's a weird place. I'm working for
Russia.
I'm pretty good friends with Alona Minkowski and Jenny Churchill, who used to work at RT on the Alona show back in the day. And then they went over to HuffPost and were at HuffPost Live, which is where I kind of met them.
And that's where you were the science editor.
Yeah, that's where I was their science correspondent. There was a science editor in New York. I did all their correspondent, like, on-air work. And so I met them there. And yeah, they've told me some pretty interesting stories, too, about RT. And a lot of stuff has been leaked lately. Like, you see it. Like, the reporters there have been more and more open about the fact that there's an obvious agenda at that news network. And I feel like when it comes to Russia reporting, you have to take it with a huge grain of salt.
Mm.
But they do a good job of investigative reporting in other parts of the world.
And also what's interesting is everybody that knows about RT primarily knows about it from clips that were released on the internet.
Yeah, they're really good about their social media.
That's
and
what's
their
up.
Viral
I mean,
videos. Yeah.
That's a big reality when it comes to all those news shows, too, and all those Tonight Show and talk shows. Their whole thing is get a clip that pops.
Oh, completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, get something that you could put on television. And then, or, you know, put on television, but then people will make a clip of it and put it on YouTube.
Even,
and everybody trades it.
I mean, look at SNL. Obviously, people still watch it if you want to believe Nielsen ratings. But, like, that show is not good anymore. It hasn't been good in a really long time. But they really reinvented themselves with the digital shorts a few years ago. And as those were getting released, I mean, there was, like, this new kind of resurgence of young people being like, oh, SNL is actually funny.
Yeah.
It's not so kind of worn out and old.
Yeah, it's the whole problem with this, and there's a bunch of problems, but trying to do a new show every week and then just doing it live in front of an audience, it's a terrible idea.
And they don't have enough. It's like, make it a half-hour show. Like, don't make it an hour. Because what ends up happening is they have good ideas for clips, and then they just, every single sketch, they just run it into the ground. It's just like, they get the joke, and then they repeat it 10 times.
Well, it's also like a super competitive environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, Phil Hartman, who is a good friend of mine, we were on news radio together, and he was on Saturday Night Live, and he had nightmare stories. Like, after talking to him about what it was like, the backstabbing and all the weird behind-the-scenes shit that goes on, people trying to force their sketches in and other people cock-blocking them, it was just like, ugh.
That sounds horrible.
The worst thing, the worst way to come up with something creative, like to have this like weird competitive environment, like no one's supporting it. I mean, I don't know how it is there now, but he told me some nightmare stories.
Yeah, and I mean, there were times when it was really amazing, but
yeah.
I don't know. It's
the
also
Belushi
kind of not my speed.
Yeah, there were some times, Eddie Murphy days. There's, you know, I mean, it's, you're always going to have talented people who are capable of being funny under extreme circumstances.
Yeah.
You can put them in the worst scenario and they could figure out how to make something funny occasionally.
But you're right. Like, it would be better if it were much looser, but it's TV, you know?
It'd also be better if they had time.
Yeah.
Like, you need some
time to work on
a sketch.
Yeah.
A once-a-month Saturday Night Live special would probably be a fucking nuclear bomb they would
it
drop.
It would be. That's true. Yeah. But people have these expectations and they want to live up to those expectations and they want to keep up with the ratings and make enough money and the old school TV model is, I don't know how much life it has left in it. The problem is that's where the money is still. It's a legacy model. It's all of the investors, all of the advertisers, it's how they know how to do their jobs because they've been doing it for so long that they still pump so much money into that machine. I mean, I see it as a freelancer. When I get offered a TV job, it always pays better than a web job. Across the board. That's where the money is still. And that's where my agent is trying to push me. I do a lot of web work because I like new media and I like that I can be free on it. But the truth is, we're still in this kind of legacy world with old school media. And until those large corporations start to understand new media, I think that you're going to see this weird inflated bubble where all the money still stays there, but nobody's even fucking watching anymore.
Yeah, it's adjusting. It's adjusting slowly, but it's definitely in this transitionary period where more people are kind of realizing, hey, isn't everybody online? Everyone's online, right?
Yeah.
So aren't the same people that are online also watching television shows? Like, we can reach them in both ways. Like, it's, and then it'll slowly shift. In my opinion, it's going to shift to the internet almost entirely. I really don't see, the only benefit that I could see in networks is things like Game of Thrones, where you need massive budgets to put on these spectacular special effects and
film everything in Ireland. Yeah, but even you're seeing Netflix starting to do that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think you will be able to see. And what happens when those production companies, or when HBO rolls out and it becomes a standalone app where you don't need the cable provider anymore, right. Then fuck, that's online too.
Yeah.
I mean, the only things that I appointment view anymore at all on television are... let's see, Masters of Sex.
What is that?
It's on Showtime.
Oh, is that the Kinsey thing?
Well, it's Masters and Johnson. So different researchers, but yeah, sex researchers from the 50s.
So is this like that movie? Who is it? Was it Liam Neeson? Who the fuck played
Is that the Kinsey movie? Yeah. So,
yeah.
So
was it him?
Kinsey and then, I don't remember, but Kinsey and Masters and Johnson are probably the most cited sex research, historical sex researchers in, you know, psychology courses where you learn about sexual behavior. But Masters and Johnson, a really interesting thing, because Masters was an OBGYN, Johnson was his research assistant, and they fucked.
Whoa.
A lot.
And that's a show.
Yeah. And so they were the source of a lot of their research.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it's Lizzie Kaplan and Michael Sheen. It's really good.
Is it?
It's a great show.
That's interesting. So, is it a pervy show? Is it kind of like a?
Well, there's a lot.
Are they trying to be like scientific about their
both.
Sex?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they totally are. But it's a new field at this point. Nobody has thought to investigate like sexual response. So they are the first people to detail what happens when you have an orgasm. They're the first people to try and take measurements of female orgasm. Like all these really, nobody thought that was legitimate research at the time. So he gets thrown out of multiple institutions and he's always getting in trouble.
It is pretty fascinating when you think about it. It wasn't until the 20th century that people started researching sex.
Oh, and
human sexuality.
And even then it was all men. Like nobody gave a shit about a female response. That was totally secondary. Like, because this is what happens. This is another little feminist soapbox.
Is that feminist though?
No,
I mean, have an issue with that term feminism.
I know. It's kind of like, it's... The term feminism, all it really means is that I support equal rights for women, you know? So in that sense of the term, yes, I'm very much a feminist, but so are you. So is probably everybody in this room and most of the people listening.
For sure.
And so this is the thing. When you don't have female physicians and you don't have female researchers because the institutions don't allow them, then you don't have a female research perspective. So all of a sudden, all of your research subjects are men because nobody thinks that it... matters to research what happens to a woman's body.
Yeah.
And it took decades for research on female sexual response to catch up to research on male sexual response, which is crazy because females are the child bearers.
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre.
I know.
Well, pretty bizarre when you think about all the different things that used to be used on women, like that women used to go to a doctor to get manually manipulated to orgasm.
Because they were like suffering from hysteria.
Yeah, hysterica.
Yeah, hysteria.
Yeah, hysterectomy, hysteria. They were all connected. Like that was the idea.
And you know, and women would go to hospitals for exhaustion. That was like a common thing.
Exhaustion.
She's hospitalized for exhaustion.
Whoa.
Which is.
Celebrities still do that.
Depression.
At least they say
yeah, they say that. But it's like, it's either depression or substance abuse.
Right. That's what they used to call it then, exhaustion. And it was only women? It wasn't men that were going to...
Men would sometimes too, but it was very common for housewives to go in
for exhaustion.
Exhaustion.
Wow. What'd they do to them? Just jerk them off? Just
they might have.
Rub them?
They might have. And they probably gave them like early versions of psychiatric medications. And they basically let them leave whatever stressful environment they were in. Get away from the babies that were making you depressed. Get away from the husband. Go be on your own for a bit. Read a fucking book.
Do you think it's fair to think that as life becomes easier and as like society and civilization is more like goods are more accessible. It's easier to get food. It's easier to get water. It's easier to get services. And then... slowly but surely, things sort of equalize in terms of the more aggressive sex, males paying more attention to the needs of the female. But in the old days, when things were much harsher, people lived less, they have a shorter lifespan, the world was a darker place, then it was more sexist. Do you think it was more like men were just like, look, these are tough times, fuck off, bitch. You know, I'm going to get mine.
I think it's probably both. I think that there's definitely you look at kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you've ever studied psychology, you've
Lizzie
probably...
Lizzie Lohan hospitalized for exhaustion.
That's amazing. you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it's like this pyramid. It's like the food pyramid, but it's the needs pyramid. And at the bottom are things like food and water and shelter. Like, when you're concerned about food and water and shelter, you're not concerned about things like love and friendship. And then as you get to the top, it's things like self-actualization and blah, blah, blah. So I think that there is a component of, yes, if you're just struggling to survive, contemplating or waxing philosophical about, you know, civil liberties and things like that, it's not in your... So you may be very instinctual and you may be aggressive because of that. Or for whatever reason, you may see kind of patriarchal lines that are drawn in the sand and some sexism and some violence. But I think on top of that, maybe that would always be the case so long as women didn't have a voice. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if just moving to the future, and I'm not sure if it has a function, if it's a function of people having more access to food and goods and services, or if it's really a function of women. Because what happened was women were mothers and men said, okay, mothers bring life. This is something that we should respect and we should honor. And this was a historical norm for a very long time. And then as, you know, these kind of hunter-gatherer societies moved into more agrarian societies and started to form cultural structures, men realized, I can overpower that bitch. Like, I have physical strength and I can physically put this woman in her place. And as they realized that there was a power differential between them, that men were physically stronger, I think that's where a lot of patriarchal wisdom comes from, is that men are physically stronger than women.
Do you think that was realized not until there was agriculture and not until there was cities? And
I think that that was a big part of it.
Don't you think that that would be a big part of it everywhere? I mean, in all primitive cultures?
Well, if you are a hunter-gatherer type, and so you're living in a very small tribe, and you're concerned about kinship or the welfare of your children, then I think that there's a certain amount of respect and honor that you are going to pay to your wife.
But why does that go away with agriculture? Why does that go away with cities?
It's not so much agriculture as it is all of the things that come along with that agriculture, which is maybe political power, which is starting to stratify and have jobs. And it, no longer are you making your own clothes, making your own shoes, doing your own hunting, doing your own cooking. All of a sudden, now you're a cobbler and you're, you know, a butcher and you're whatever. And so people have to depend on one another for goods and services, and they have to say, okay, I'll trade you this for that, and then money comes into play and bartering. And all of a sudden, whereas it was a lot more egalitarian before, where everybody kind of had a strong role because they were taking care of themselves or their very small groups, their family groups, now all of a sudden they have a place in society. And that's, I think, where you really start to see subjection of women, is because men start to develop power within societies. And if you look back historically, there are no known societies that were matriarchal societies, but you do see in smaller kind of tribal communities more matriarchal ideology, more kind of honoring and worshiping of mother figures and mother gods. But every time there's a society, it becomes patriarchal historically throughout all
time.
Every time. There's no such thing as those. Yeah, all of it. Yeah. There's no such thing as those Amazonian, like, women tribe that, you know, people talk about, like, the Amazonian women.
That's just dudes jerk off fantasies.
Yeah, and that's not a real thing.
Like, giant women are going to take care of them.
Yeah, it's a myth. It's a myth.
Stuff them in their vaginas.
So, and I don't know. I can't say that that's a cause of it, but those things are highly correlated.
But do you think that that evens out once civilization and society becomes more complex and has... See, my point was that scarcity makes people desperate. And when people get desperate, they victimize not just women, but they victimize weaker men as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyone weak. It's like, you know, who are the people that we historically look to for, like, heroic figures in times of great stress? People that pull themselves up by their bootstraps and go out there and kick some fucking ass.
People with big muscles, too. I mean, that's the thing. It's such a brutish and such an underdeveloped way to value strength, to only value strength in, like, I punch harder. Right? Because there's other forms of strength. But you're right. When people are desperate, people know that the, you know, think about if you're having an argument with another guy, or if something comes to a head, even at work, wherever, and you're having an argument and you can't agree with each other and you start to get more and more frustrated. What's the way in every film, in every book, what's the way that it finally gets settled? You roll up your sleeves and you get in a physical altercation with each other, which is just not a form of strength or not a form of settling a score that's common in like in females. It happens.
Have Don't you never watched Basketball Wives?
Yeah, it
Those
it happens.
Bitches throw down. They
do.
Hair.
They throw down. But that's like the worst of the worst too. That's like not normal.
It's counterintuitive, but the best way to avoid that with men is martial arts. Get men in a situation where they train and they compete against each other on a regular basis. They don't have this need to dominate each other the way.
True, because I do think that it's a bit stupid to just completely ignore the role that things like testosterone play in gender dimorphism, like in female-male differences in humans and other higher-order mammals. Like, testosterone is a chemical that actually is highly linked to things like aggression and feeling tension and having this need to release that in some way. And we have less of it. We have significantly less of it. And some women are more aggressive and some women are completely passive and are never aggressive that way. But there is a significant difference between males and females, and testosterone is a big reason for that. So being able to get that aggression out, whether it's on a heavy bag or whether it's through martial arts or whatever exercises you use, I think it's irresponsible to think that that's not part of the equation.
Yeah, it definitely is for a man coming from a male point of view. Mm-hmm. I know it makes a significant difference with me whether or not I can release it or not. But it's also the just doing martial arts and being involved in something that gives you an understanding of what physical confrontation is really all about. It's not this scary thing that every man has to like puff his chest up to avoid happening, or you go into it completely ignorantly thinking it's like a movie, like you're going to sock some guy and that's going to be the end of it, and meanwhile you throw a punch at him and he moves his head and you're like, oh shit, this guy actually knows how to fight, now I'm fucked because now I tried to hit somebody that is not going to let me hit him and they're going to beat me up.
You're right, a lot of that I think comes from fear and it comes from ignorance.
It also comes from the ridiculous these media depictions of what happens when people hit each other. One of the things that drives me fucking crazy, and I really wanted to talk to you about this because mm-hmm. I wanted to get into depression, is head trauma. Like, there's so many goddamn movies where someone hits someone in the head and they fall down, they get up and they rub their head and they're out cold, and then they go out and they fucking have a crazy fist fight with 100 people, or, you know, they make it like they're back to normal. Like, they get shut off and they come back to normal and they're fine.
Or a guy is like, you know, this like great martial artist is in a fight with like 10 other dudes, right? And then he's like punching and he's kicking. And then he does that thing where he like headbutts. Like tons of guys, like cracks his skull against the skull of like multiple people in a row and is like in no way affected by it.
Well, headbutts, it's really a weird thing, but the way to do it correctly, it actually is effective because
I'm sure it's effective.
You're using this part of your head, your forehead, mm-hmm. which is a really hard part, and you smash someone in the nose. And your nose kind of gives in.
It's so gross.
Yeah, but it works. It works like crazy.
I wish we had a shot of Red Band just then when he was.
Well, there's a great video of a woman knocking a guy out in a bar. There was some sort of a bar fight, mm-hmm. and this guy was like involved in a fight with this woman's boyfriend, and the guy grabs the woman, and the woman grabs the guy's shirts and slams him in the head. Right on his nose, and the guy goes out cold and goes limp. And it's hilarious because it's like this little woman and this big man, and she knocks him out with her head.
Yeah, but they never show that in the movie. They never hit him in the nose. They hit him like in the same part of their head.
Yeah, you can't do that.
You can't
well,
do
you
that.
Can,
you're gonna scramble your brain.
If you're Samoan, if you're like one of those dudes with an extra big head, you can get away with that. But for most people, you smash them in the nose.
I mean, you probably don't want to do that too much. We're even seeing that there are.
Is this that video?
Yeah.
Watch this girl headbutt this dude. It's fucking hilarious. Because there's all this shit going on, and this girl just grabs this dude and KOs him. See if you can cut to it, because it's kind of a long video, if I remember correctly. There's like a lot of shit going on.
Oh, yeah. Big bar fight.
Oh, just isolate it, because this is...
Is he punching her?
No, I think, yeah.
Oh, my God. Dude, that's insane.
Yeah, I don't know when in this video. I don't think this is the same video. I think this is a different one.
Ugh.
Yeah, this isn't the same video.
That's just gross to see.
The other video was indoors. That one's outdoors. But whatever.
But yeah, like even, you know, they're finding that soccer players.
Oh, yeah.
Just the movement of like hitting a ball mm-hmm. with your head over and over and over and over and over causes mild concussive injuries. So, yeah, cracking people in the skulls a lot is probably...
Yeah, it's not
to
good.
To be avoided.
Well, you know, and me, I come from this background of not just constantly doing it my whole life, but being around it my whole life.
Yeah.
I've been around so many guys getting hit in the head, and I've seen them from the beginning of their career, and then I see them at the end of their career, and I see a significant decline in how they communicate and how I'm sure how they feel.
They seem like old men when they're in their like 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And depression is a real issue. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up is because my friend Mark Gordon, Dr. Mark Gordon, who's an expert in traumatic brain injury, and he works a lot with soldiers and athletes that have had significant brain trauma, and they have a lot of issues with their hormones afterwards.
Mm.
The pituitary gland is extremely sensitive. And he wrote a piece connecting Robin Williams with depression, not just based on a lot of factors. I mean, Robin had a lot of things going on. He obviously had substance abuse issues. He obviously he had the Parkinson's issue, which he was also taking medication for Parkinson's, which has been connected to depression. But he also had heart surgery. And Dr. Gordon's connection was that Robin Williams, having had this major heart valve replacement, which entails many hours of anesthesia, lowered blood pressure, and the literature speaks of post-cardiac surgery depression in over 100 publications, and that the prolonged surgery with low blood pressure, they believe, precipitates a form of Sheehan syndrome, which is the loss of important brain hormones.
Oh, interesting.
Additionally, there's an increase in reverse T3 and a decrease in T3, which can cause relative hypothyroidism that's also associated with depression. And Mark Gordon wrote this whole piece about it, and he's saying that what people have to consider more is, like, when you take someone into a situation where you're fixing their heart, you also have to realize that there's going to be some adverse effect. The whole body's going to react to this.
Yeah.
And it's not just going to be about, look, your heart's fixed. You know, why are you so sad? You know, like, his hormones are fucking completely out of whack now. And that could have played a factor in this that was ignored.
Well, and that's something that I think that we've historically had this really weird approach to medicine, which I think is kind of a secondary effect of thinking scientifically. And obviously, my background is in neuroscience. I worked as a scientist for many years, and I am very much a scientific thinker, and I'm all about the scientific method. But I think that we sometimes are at fault when we're a little bit too reductionistic in our views. And so if you look at the history of modern medicine, of evidence-based medicine, what ends up happening is that we look at a problem and we try to fix the problem, and we look at it as if you can somehow cut that piece of the person's physiology completely out of them, solve it, and then put it right back in. And it doesn't have any effect on anything else in their bodies. I mean, you look at medication, right? Any form of pharmaceutical, they all have side effects. If you think about what a side effect is, it comes down to how medication works. Medicine is a molecule. It's some sort of molecule that fits in a receptor somewhere in your body. And the idea is that you want it to have really high efficacy. So let's say that I'm somebody who has a problem with blood pressure, for example. Or actually, let's just jump into depression, because I've been talking about this a lot lately around Robin Williams. I had Paul Gilmartin on my podcast just last week to talk about that. He hosts the Mental Illness Happy Hour podcast and has really great insights into mental illness. And I, of course, publicly have dealt with depression most of my life. I take medication every day. I go to therapy every week. I'm very open about it.
Isn't that, for a lot of people, they would look at you, especially people that don't have any issues with depression, they look at you, obviously, very intelligent, beautiful, young. Why would you be depressed? Guys are probably tripping over themselves trying to date you. You're obviously very successful in pursuing intellectual pursuits. Why would you be depressed?
Exactly.
Like, a lot of people are like, why?
Because a lot of people don't understand the difference between depression and sadness. And they don't understand that depression is a biological illness.
Yeah, they don't think of it. They also don't think of it in terms of, like, people look at it in terms of, like, well, you've got all these sums. Like,
exactly.
Look, you've got all these numbers. Look, these all stack
up. And that almost can make it worse for certain people. I mean, you look at somebody like Robin Williams. He had so much going for him, right?
Yes.
He was famous. He was loved. He had all this money. How could he be depressed? He didn't have the problems that you or I have. And you know what? Then you have this extra layer of guilt. You have this extra layer of shame, this extra layer of, why the fuck am I still depressed? No matter how much success I get, no matter how much money I make, no matter how much people write me letters and say that they love me and whatever, I can't seem to beat this feeling inside of me, this constellation of symptoms, because it's not coming from that. It's coming from your brain.
And isn't, I mean, I don't suffer from depression, but I have had many friends who do. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered what it's, because it seems to be that when you go to a doctor and they start treating it, whether they treat it with medication or they try to adjust your diet and prescribe exercise first, that there's no like one simple fix.
Not at all.
And everybody's completely different.
And people get upset about that, because I think it goes back to kind of what I was talking about before, which is a meandering way to okay, so again, to go back to this idea of a drug, you take a drug. Let's say I take an antidepressant. My antidepressant specifically is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, an SSRI, that's called citalopram. That's the off-brand. I think it's Celexa is the brand name. I take that. It binds to my serotonin receptors in my brain, and it allows me to dump more serotonin into the synapse, the gap between two brain cells, so that I always have more available. It basically tells my brain that I need more serotonin, so I make more serotonin available to myself. It's a reuptake inhibitor. And so, it keeps more serotonin in the gap instead of sucking it back into the cells, so I always have more available to me. Now, it's a molecule. It's got a shape, just like anything out there. It has geometry. So it binds to this specific receptor in the brain because it's got a similar shape to that. There are other things in your body that are similarly shaped. And so what ends up happening is when you take a drug, the specificity of the drug is only based on whether or not the key fits in a lock somewhere in your body. But let's say that you had hundreds of thousands, millions of locks available to you and one key, and you started going through. You'd be able to stick that in a bunch of locks. Some of them, it might even turn, but it would fit in the lock of multiple locks hanging on that wall. So what ends up happening is I take this drug, it binds in my brain, it does what it's supposed to do in my brain, but it also maybe does other shit, like makes me really fucking tired, or it makes it so I don't want to have sex as often. It's a side effect. And the reason that you have a side effect is because there's other parts of your body that the drug binds to. It's the same thing with medicine. Like you were saying, you operate on somebody's heart. The heart is connected to other things. It's the source of blood flow throughout your body. It is connected to hormone levels. There's all sorts of things that can happen when you put somebody under anesthesia, when you cut them open, when you you cause an immune response, an inflammatory response. Your body is a holistic thing. And so when you start jacking with certain things, other things are going to happen. That doesn't mean you should throw the baby out with the bathwater, but medicine is a risk-benefit analysis always.
But how do they find the... It seems to me that they find the right medication by experimentation, that they try it. And is that just
because... It's the only way. It's because we don't have any tests. You can't go... as a doctor, you can't come to me, stick a needle in my spinal cord, take out my cerebrospinal fluid, and measure how much serotonin I have in it. I wish you could. I wish I could take some sort of a blood test, or I could, you know, pee in a cup, and then you could analyze that pee and say, you're low on serotonin. You need an SSRI. That would be what works for you. Because other people's depression comes from problems with dopamine, comes from problems with norepinephrine, or some combination thereof. But there's no test for it. It fucking sucks. There's no test for it. And so what ends up happening is you have to play musical chairs. You try a drug, maybe the first drug I tried when I decided to finally go on antidepressants fucked me up so bad. I took an SNDRI, a selective serotonin norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor. I was so fucking depressed I couldn't function, and we decided, let's throw the book at it. Let's take the drug of all drugs, the monster drug that does everything. And I couldn't sleep for a week. I felt like I was on straight up crank, like on crystal.
Did you get a lot done?
I quit smoking. No, seriously, I quit smoking. It was awesome. That's okay. When I quit smoking.
Well, that's an important point. Uh-huh. Smoking. Smoking is terrible for your body.
Horrible.
Did you do anything to try to naturally stimulate your body to produce more serotonin? Did you try a lot of exercise? Did you adjust your diet? But you didn't quit smoking.
I did. I mean, ultimately.
When you got on the drugs. But you didn't try.
I was only on the drug for a week. So as soon as I got off the drug again, I immediately wanted to smoke again. But at that point, I pushed through it. And I said, mm-hmm. you know, I'm at my lowest. I was at my lowest point I've ever been at. So I was like, fuck it. Can't get any worse. And I did. I quit smoking. And it's been a couple of years. But I did. I tried. But the truth is, this is why addiction research is so important. This is why researchers go into the lab with a bunch of mice or whatever, and they feed them a bunch of cocaine, and they, you know, do these different kind of experiments where you've heard of the famous experiment where you have the mouse in the cage, and it's got a bar pressing paradigm. Mm-hmm. So it can push the bar, it gets coke. And then, like, it just fucking does that until it dies. Like, there's food right next to it, and it's like, no, I want more coke, and then it just, you know, dies. And so obviously there's something happening. This is a natural phenomenon, because mice don't have value judgments. They're not thinking about this from a religious perspective. They're not saying, I don't know, maybe I should stop doing this coke and maybe exercise a little more and that'll give me the same kind of high. It overwhelms everything. It's such a strong addiction.
Does nicotine have the same sort of addictive properties?
Nicotine is almost more addictive.
Nicotine as far as like pipe smoke.
I do think nicotine is still addictive, even if you're talking about like vaping it or something like that.
No, I'm talking about like traditional methods of it, like the way they would smoke tobacco in a pipe or in a cigar or something. It's not as addictive.
I don't think it's as addictive, but it's still addictive. Mm. I mean, it's the nicotine is the molecule that's studied in laboratories. It's not the tar. It's not the shit that comes in the papers. Now, that's what like has much more carcinogenic properties, but nicotine itself is highly addictive, and that's the molecule that's studied in research. It's pure nicotine.
But isn't nicotine itself, doesn't it actually have some medicinal benefits?
It does. It's actually neuroprotective, so it can protect against Parkinson's.
Wow. So if you smoke, you won't get Parkinson's?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but there is some evidence in the lab that animals that were given nicotine had a lower incidence rate of Parkinson's.
Is it dangerous in like the form that people take it, as far as like gum or things along those
much
lines?
Less. It's much less dangerous. But the goal still would be to get off of nicotine, because the reason they're chewing the gum is because they're still addicted to it.
But is there a way to take a small amount of it that gives you those neuroprotective properties, but it's not dangerous?
Possibly. I think it would be important for us to see more research to see how. You know, again, it's a risk-benefit analysis. Like, is it really that beneficial? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard to say. What's the dose-response curve? How much would you have to take for it to be beneficial?
The thing about depression that mm-hmm. is fascinating to me is that there are some correlations between how well your life is going. Do you have
Hugely.
Good relationships?
Yeah.
Are you happy with what you choose to do with your day? I had a friend who was, he was on like some serious SSRIs, and they changed his life. They got him. He quit his job, started his own business, got involved in relationship. And then once he got to a really good place, he slowly weaned himself off the antidepressants, and now he's great.
Yeah, and that happens to a lot of people. And so I think that there's different. What we have to understand, too, is, of course, all psychiatric disorders are spectrum disorders, right? There's really extreme examples, and there's barely any examples. And if anybody who's ever taken a psych course or who's studied, you know, if you were a psych major in college, you know that as you study the DSM-4, which is like, it's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that they use in psychiatry and psychology, it's basically the big Bible of all the things you can be diagnosed with. The more you study it, the more you're like, I have that. Oh, I have that. Oh, I totally fucking have that. And you realize everybody can convince themselves that they have these. It's like WebMD, you know what I mean? So it's only once it is sufficiently detrimental to your life that it affects your relationships, it affects your ability to work, it affects your health, whatever the case may be. And usually within the DSM, there are maybe like 8 things, and it's like you have to have 5 out of these 8 things. And so anybody can read it and go, oh, I've felt depression before. But what they don't realize is there is a difference between depression and sadness. There's also a difference between parody depression, so depression that lasts years, decades, and the type of depression that people get that's directly linked to life events.
Your dog dies.
You look, well, a big one. You lose your fucking job. Like, we've seen so many documentaries lately about this. As the economy took a downturn, people lose their job, and then they end up committing suicide because they can't. It's like this cascade of awfulness. That's a really common one. You know, family member dies, you have a stillborn, or you have an abortion, or you have a baby, a healthy baby. Postpartum depression is incredibly common. And in that case, that's much more common that people can take meds, they can do all these things, and once they get back to where they were before that horrible life event, they're okay to get off the meds. Some people are able to get their depression managed without medication perfectly well.
But it's
some people aren't.
Is the different reactions that different people have to different medication, is it because their depression has a different source, or is it just a biodiversity thing?
I think it's more of a biodiversity thing than a source thing. I mean, a source is hard to say. So depression is both when you think about it. Well, brain and mind are the same thing. You know, most modern neuroscientists say that brain and mind are two sides of the same coin, that mind is just an emergent property of brain. Nobody's a dualist anymore. They don't think that you can like heal the mind and it has no effect on the brain, because it's the same fucking thing. So there are, you know, some people's depression comes from the fact that their dopamine levels are not healthy, or their norepinephrine levels are not healthy, or whatever the fuck. But I think the common view of depression now is that there's some sort of biological difference in your brain. And oftentimes that's either caused or it develops out of childhood or early life experiences where, you know, you have some sort of trauma, or you have some sort of development, you have some sort of, you know, interaction with family, whatever the case may be. And it doesn't have to be, you know, you were molested as a child. It can literally just be like you didn't feel loved, or whatever the case may be. And you've got this brain difference combined with this emotional experience. And what ends up happening, because when you're very young, your brain is very plastic. So when you're very young, you're learning skills that are going to last you the rest of your life. And you're actually building your brain architecture. Certain neurons are connecting and disconnecting and reconnecting and pruning out. The tree, the beautiful tree that is all of the cells in your brain, is getting pruned when you're young. And if you're depressed when you're young, and you're experiencing those kinds of things when you're young, you're going to prune a tree that's prone to depression as you age, because you're going to keep reinforcing those neuronal connections. That's why therapy is so important. Meds in and of themselves are never going to get you in a place where your depression is really well managed. It's going to get you in a place where therapy is going to be working better for you. Meds are going to be an immediate and necessary interventional strategy so that you're not crying, or you're not trying to kill yourself, or you're not whatever your symptoms of, so you can actually fucking get out of bed to work on yourself. That's what meds are there for me. Meds keep me from staying in bed all day.
That's that variable, though. Finding the right counselor has got to be incredibly difficult.
It's tough. It's like, I always liken it to the women who are listening to the podcast. I liken it unto when you were first deciding to go on birth control. A lot of women will go to their gynecologist when they're 15, 16, 17 and say, I want to go on birth control. And they'll give them orthotricycline or whatever the pill, the regular old pill, and they'll be fine. A lot of women will take the pill the first time and it'll make them really sick. Like every time they take the pill, it makes them want to throw up, or it gives them cramps, or something's weird about it. It affects theirs. And they go, oh, this drug doesn't work for me. And they go, oh, fuck, okay, let's try one with lower levels of estrogen or progesterone, or let's try the ring or the Depo-Provera shot, or maybe you need an IUD. I was like that. It took me multiple times to find the right drug. And I think it's the same thing with therapy. I think it's the same thing with psychiatric medicines. It's not, we're not monolithic. So the same combination isn't going to work for everybody. And the truth is, if that makes you afraid of modern medicine, or if it makes you think that psychiatry is woo or something like that, it's the same thing as cancer in many ways. There's so many parallels. Cancer is not one disease. It's a spectrum of diseases. If I got diagnosed with breast cancer and you got diagnosed with breast cancer and we both went in with our diagnosis the same day, our oncologist would give us different treatments because we would have different genetic markers. We would respond differently to different types of chemotherapy. Chemotherapy means chemical therapy. It's a really big umbrella term for all the different kinds of cancer treatments that are available. Maybe you would get more radiation. Maybe I would need surgery, but your metastasis would make it so that surgery wasn't a viable option. It's a spectrum disease, and psychiatric illness are the same way.
The variable, though, of the counselor has to be kind of weird.
It
right?
is weird.
Just
it's a bit weird.
Trying to find someone that you can confide in wholeheartedly. And
it takes time. A really long time.
Finding the correct sex, right? Whether or not some men do better with women counselors.
I have a male counselor. It's funny. I have a male therapist, but I have a female gynecologist. Like, I would never in a million years let a dude, like, put speculums in me and, like, dig around in my cervix. But I'm totally comfortable with a male therapist.
I have a friend who went to a male gynecologist, and the male gynecologist texted her and asked her out.
Oh, that's so creepy.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my God.
But she's kind of a flirt. She might have put it out there.
Oh, that's crazy. Then, that reminds me of, what's the Judd Apatow?
She pushed forward.
What's the Judd Apatow movie?
She, like, moaned a little while he was getting in there.
Ew, ew, ew. No, you would never. You have obviously never had a pap. You would never.
No, I haven't, but some girls are dirty bitches.
But
in
no,
a good way.
What's the Judd Apatow movie with Knocked Up? You know, and she goes to the doctor, and it's her sister's doctor, and he's all like, oh, I recognize you now. Like, when he puts her in this, it's like so gross.
Yeah, having some dude dig around your cooter.
I could never. I just could never. I'm glad that I'm glad it's 2014 and there are plenty of female OBGYNs available, because back in the day, you had a male gynecologist.
Right.
Because there were only dude doctors.
Whoa. Yeah, that would be really weird. Uh-huh. And even for a guy to have a woman doctor that's checking out your genitals, that would be odd as well.
You think so? Would you have you've had a female doctor before, right? Like, grab your balls while you cough, that kind
no,
of thing?
No, I wish.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the issue. Like, the man would be the predator. Like, that the female doctor would have to deal with, especially if it was an attractive female doctor, would have to deal with the dude.
Oh, being kind of
excited about a woman checking out his balls. I'm not sure. Keep doing it. I'm not sure if you found it.
Yeah, that she'd probably have to deal with that a bit.
Sure. Fuck yeah, sure. Well, there's, you know, I was talking to a friend about this the other day, and he is a pretty philosophical older guy, and he was, he's been through two divorces, and he was talking about how sex-starved so many people are. Hmm. And, like, you're dealing with all these scenarios where you're like, oh, this guy was a creep, and this, you know, this woman is ridiculous. And there are people out there that no one's touching, and they are so hungry just to be held. And I mean, this is a minor story, but when I was when I first came to California, I didn't have any friends. Came here from New York, and I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy because I didn't enjoy acting. I didn't enjoy being around actors, and I didn't have any friends. And it wasn't didn't have a girlfriend, didn't have any dates. And I got a hug from this girl on the set, and I'll never forget that feeling of that hug, because it wasn't like a sexual hug. It was a friend gave me a hug, and when she gave me the hug, it was like my level went, but not sexual. Mm-hmm. It was like love. Like, I got touched.
You got a love boner.
I got touched for the first time in like a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, you need this. Like, this is important for people.
It's totally important for people. There's all sorts of hormones, like a cascade of hormones that you set off when you are affiliative, when you're, you know, close to somebody else. And it's absolutely necessary. And kind of going back to what we were talking about aggression, like a male-female difference, I also feel strongly that many men have a deep need that's slightly different than women, that our sexual needs are much more affiliative and emotional, and there is some physiological basis for female sexual need, don't get me wrong. Like, any girl can tell you that she's had this craving, this passionate feeling where she's like, I just need to come, or I just need to, you know, have sex with somebody. But with men, there's literally a backup of fluid that you have to release. That's a very different physiological thing than women. And again, that goes back to testosterone. So the same thing as you were saying, MMA can be really helpful for clearing the mind and for lowering your base levels of aggression. I think coming does the same thing. I think it's healthy for guys to jerk off if they're not having a lot of sex, because guys can get pent up and be aggressive because they're not coming enough.
Well, they also get desperate. I had a joke about it. It was a whole descriptive called jerk off first, then think about it. Mm. Like, anything you're thinking about doing in life, any weird decision you're going to make, you're getting married, that's good. Jerk off first, then think about it. You know, you're going to decide to do this, you're going to buy that car, you're going to do this, you're going to buy those clothes. Jerk off first and tell me if you really want to wear alligator shoes. Like, why are you wearing those? Are you trying to attract a certain person? Like,
and that's the thing. We talk about the little head and people, guys thinking with that head or whatever. There is a really big neuronal link there. There are hormones that affect your dick the same way they affect your brain. And so you can't pretend, again, that your cock is somehow completely disconnected from your emotions, from your feelings.
Well, if
it's
you looked
not.
At it, and also if you looked at it objectively, if you looked at the human beings on this planet as like a giant mathematical equation, you would say, okay, why are there so fucking many of them? Well, because there's this intense need to breed.
Mm-hmm.
And this intense need to breed was back when it was really difficult to stay alive. You know, we are essentially the same organism that used to get cut down by each other, by animals, predators, natural illnesses, disease, injuries.
We've only been around for 200,000 years in our current form, Homo sapiens as a species. So before 200,000 years ago, we're talking about something that was different enough from us, evolutionarily speaking, to be a different species. Homo sapiens, 200,000 years old. That's long enough for a little bit of evolution. Yes, we have changed in some ways, but that's not long enough for that much evolution. In many ways, biologically, psychologically, evolutionarily speaking, you're right. We are the same organism that was like crawling out of the trees.
Yeah, extremely primitive. And again, when you also talk about the biodiversity, there's some folks that are just more fucking primitive today.
Totally.
Or more animalistic or more kinetic.
And just the range is so massive when we talk about what is, quote, normal and what is hyper and what is hypo. So many people are so different. And that's why it's cool to see when people actually manage to partner up, or whatever sexual or emotional partnerships make sense for them, whether they're monogamous or polygamous, whether they're, you know, gay, straight, somewhere in between. It's so cool when you see people that make it work because they're on the same page. When there's so many differences that exist out there, when two people go, you're awesome, or three or four, whatever, and they go, you're awesome, I'm into you, we're into the same stuff, we abide by the same rules, we have the same sexual proclivities, and it works. Like, how fucking cool is that? Because there's so many combinations out there. When those magnets, those two ends of the magnet kind of find each other in that way, it's pretty dope. Like, it's not that common.
Well, even like when you were talking earlier about molecules and receptors, mm-hmm. it's almost like you have to have the right fit.
Yeah, you know? Totally
and
do.
You also have to be a good molecule.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how many people truly have their shit together to the point where anybody would want to be with them? And so many people are so goddamn codependent and so fucked up mm-hmm. that they can't attract anyone because their own biology, their psychology, the mix that makes them a person is just so chaotic. Like, you can't expect to be happy in a relationship because you're not happy alone.
Yeah, there has to be equity in a relationship. Like, you can't suck the light. You can't be like a vampire in a relationship. You have to offer somebody just as much as you get from them. And you have to be, like you said, very standalone. I mean, that's a common theme for me in therapy, is this conversation about, if I am in a relationship, feeling very confident and comfortable, because I have like an insane fear of commitment. Because I'm so used to thinking about a relationship as if it's a prison sentence. And I've been really relearning what it means to be in a relationship with my therapist, and how the idea of living for now is a healthier way to look at life. Like, I don't have to think about hardcore future kinds of conversations. Like, if I'm comfortable with myself right now, and I can be comfortable with a partner right now, and not have all this like sense of intense obligation, that's where that codependent stuff comes from. And that's what I think is so incredibly unhealthy in a relationship. It's like, I'm going to bring my best self to the table, and hopefully I'll find a partner that does the same thing, instead of needing a partner, which is a common motivation for people to get in relationships. I need somebody else. I can't handle it on my own. Well then you're not going to end up working it out.
There's all those variables too, like the sexual variable, the emotional variable. There's so many different things that are going on, and then it's almost like, okay, I found this water hole. I can't leave.
Yeah.
I finally found water. I was alone. Like, my experience of going several weeks without being hugged, and then being hugged, and like, oh, And that was just a friend. It was like someone on the set. The difference between that and someone who's gone years without a relationship that really worked, and you finally have one that works, and you fuck it up because you're too goddamn clingy and too crazy.
That's really common.
Where are you? Why aren't you home? I'm texting you. Why aren't you texting me back immediately?
And like that kind of shit is what makes me run out the door. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about my quote unquote fear of commitment. What it really is it's an intense feeling of stress when I feel obligated to somebody else. Mm. So in the healthiest relationships I've been in, they're the relationships where there's not a lot of jealousy, not a lot of possession, not a lot of that checking in and these it's just trust.
Yeah.
You trust each other. And when you're really into somebody, you want to be around them and you spend time with them. But when you want to be around your friends, they're not like, where are you? Why aren't you checking in? When are you coming home? It's like, fuck off, dude. Like, I don't want to be with you if it's going to be like this.
There are friends like that and they're brutal and you got to cut them off.
Yeah, you do. Because that's that codependent thing. And what happens when you end up with two people who are like that with each other?
Murder-suicide.
Yeah, and they less and less learn how to exist on their own. So then when they finally do break it off, because it's obviously unhealthy, then they're fucked. Yeah. Then it takes all this healing to get back to a place where they're independent again.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's a weird thing when you find those two people that, like, they can't be apart. Like, they literally, they go everywhere together.
They're
do everything
so
together.
They're also so gross. Like, nobody wants to be around them. They're the worst. You have friends like that, don't you?
Yeah.
I cut off all my friends.
Oh, you have no friends.
You have friends? I'm your friend, fuckface. Yeah. What are you talking about?
I mean, all my shit friends.
Bro. Oh, your shit friend. That's good. Yeah, cutting off shit friends is...
Cut off all my friends. It's just me and my girl now, bro. We're out there riding motorcycles.
Well, I think the older you get, you just realize, why am I friends with these people? You
know? That happens, too. That's true. When you're younger, you need a lot of support. And I think the older you get, the more you value your alone time. And the more you realize that good relationships and good friendships shouldn't feel like work.
Mm-hmm.
And once they start to feel like work, you're like, fuck, I have too many obligations and responsibilities. Ugh, I don't want to have to work to be friends with you.
Also, I have a lot of friends that are like super empowering. Like when I'm around them, I want to do better.
Yeah.
I want to be better. I get stimulated. You know, I think better. My mind functions. Like I'm inspired, you know.
I'm very lucky to have that now. You know, you were talking about your experience when you first came to Los Angeles and not having a lot of friends and kind of being depressed. And so when I first moved to L.A., I was in New York. I'm usually not that comfortable talking about this, but for some reason I'm going to right now. I was living in New York and I was working on my PhD, and then I started dating Bill Maher. Like, that's why I came to Los Angeles, is because we started dating. I was living in New York. I would kind of come and go and see him, and we weren't committed to each other. I had a life on the West or on the East Coast. He had his life here on the West Coast. And eventually we got close enough that we decided, hey, let's give this thing a go. And so I was like, fuck it. I was actually really not happy in my degree program. So in some ways it was a double whammy. I was very happy to be exploring a deeper relationship with this guy that I had grown to love. And also, I was more and more not happy with my situation in New York. And so it was a new opportunity. I moved out to LA, and we ultimately ended up dating very seriously for about 3 years. And that was my first LA experience. Was bizarre as fuck. I was dating somebody who was incredibly famous in the public eye, who had a lot of money. There was a big equity problem in the relationship. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I had just left my degree program. I was searching for answers, and I was young. I was like 24. But I had no friends. None. Mm. I mean, I was friends with people in their 50s. Like, that was my social circle. And yeah, I would meet people. Like, I would hang out with Sarah Silverman a little bit, but they weren't really my friends. I was the come along. I was the girlfriend, and they were all very nice to me. And I was like, what a weird life. But it was almost like I was living somebody else's life. And I was pretty depressed. And I was very lucky to have my best friend at the time, Kelly, was still living in Dallas, where I grew up. And kind of worked with her and hooked her up with a job working with Bill. She ended up becoming his wardrobe stylist, and she still does that to this day, which is really amazing. It was a huge opportunity for her. She always wanted to come to LA, and now she's this incredible celebrity stylist and has this great job. And so I was very lucky when she first came out, maybe 6 months later, because we got an apartment together and I finally had somebody, but I just had her. And it took probably until just a couple of years ago, so now that's maybe been 5 years out, before I met this group of friends that we affectionately call each other the Nerd Brigade. We hashtag Nerd Brigade on Twitter all the time. And they're like One of my best friends just finished her PhD in molecular neuroscience from Caltech. One of my other best friends got his PhD from USC in animal cognition. I have a friend who, another neuroscience student at Caltech. I have a friend who has a marine biology degree. They're all like science communicators, writers, academics, but cool, young, edgy, fun people who, like, we get each other. We're friends because we have a lot in common. It took a long time to get close to these people and to meet them and to finally find, because LA is a fucking hard city if you're used to living in a university town. Like, there, it's so hard to meet.
What town were you in?
Well, first, I was in Denton, Texas. That's where I did my undergrad and my master's at the University of North Texas. And then, yeah, I was in New York City, but I was living in Queens, specifically in Forest Hills, because I would take the bus to Flushing every day to Queens College. That's where I was working on my PhD at the City University of New York Graduate Center. But Queens College was my campus. And a lot of my friends live in Pasadena still, which is very much a college town because they were Caltech students and now they're working there, or some of them are still taking courses. But Brian just shook his head. Like, LA, it's hard to meet smart people in this city. It's so full of fucking vapid people and people who will, I learned this quickly. I moved to LA dating somebody who was like an A-list celebrity. And all of a sudden, I was like, wait, why do you want to be friends with me? Wait, what's going on? I also, I've dated another very, very famous person in my life where I don't publicly talk about that relationship at all, just to respect each other's privacy. But I would learn things about people. Like, I had this one group of friends who I thought were my friends. And I remember dating this person and being like, hey, do you want to come to a barbecue? I don't know. Oh, but, you know, so-and-so thought that you might want to play tennis. We're going to do it at so-and-so's house. Oh, so-and-so will be there? Oh, yeah, I'm totally down. And you would get that all the time. This, like, oh, is that why you're friends with me?
Yeah, that LA thing is very bizarre.
It's such a weird experience that I think a lot of people don't, I never even imagine. But it also has opened a million doors for me. Like, how the fuck, you think when I was 23 years old, you know, cutting up mice or birds and digging around in their brains. I always thought I was going to be a bench scientist, and that's what I was going to do. And I kind of hated it. I love teaching, kind of hated doing the lab work, but I was like, okay, this is the path I'm on. This is who the fuck, if somebody had told me, oh, you're going to be in media, you're going to be on the Joe Rogan podcast, you're going to start your own podcast, you're going to be on television, I'd be like, you're fucking out of your mind. Like, I'm scared of camera. When I was in Texas at 16, I tried out for season 2 of American Idol.
You sing?
Yeah. I was a jazz singer in college. Like, that's what I went to college for. Yeah. And so I made it through 4 callbacks in season 2 of American Idol. I made it through the producers, the executive producers, I finally got to the 3 judges. Who were they? The main ones. It was like Randy and Paula and Simon Cowell. And so that was the last audition you do before you, I'm going to Hollywood, right? And you know why I didn't get in? All 3 of them said, like, you're not. They go, we like your voice, we like your look, because I was a total punk rock kid. I had like short spiky hair and my lip ring and the arm, it was very Avril Lavigne kind of a look back then. And they were like, oh, we love it all, you're the total package. And I was like, great. And then I auditioned and they were like, you're not going through. And oh, but why? And they were like, you are not TV ready. I was so afraid of the cameras. I like didn't have that dynamic personality that all of the reality TV stars have, where they're like, I'm going to win this competition because I'm the best. I just walked up and I was like, are you ready for me to sing? I'm so scared. Like, it was, I was meek. I didn't have that kind of self-assertive thing going on.
So you developed that?
I think I did. I think it happened from getting thrown into it.
Hmm.
I think what happens is when you're like, okay, I'm just working, I'm in the lab. And also, I taught. Between then and now, I've taught like a million courses. So that helps. You stand up in front of a classroom and you go, you don't understand glycolysis? We're going to figure this out together up on the whiteboard, and you're helping the students. So that helps with your confidence for sure. But also, I think getting thrown into it, I come to LA and it's like, oh, let's go to the Emmys. Let's walk this red carpet. Let's do all, and then, you know, you're all of a sudden in the room with all these really important people and you don't even know who they are. Like, I would go to parties where every single person there was a celebrity. And the people you didn't recognize because they owned movie studios. Like, it was the weirdest feeling. And then once you realize I'm not that different from these people, I can have a conversation with them like anyone else. And I would talk about science. I'd be like, science is awesome. Let me tell you this story. And they'd go, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then eventually Bill was like, you need to be doing this on television. You need to be trying this at least, because I think you'd be good at it. he completely and utterly pushed me into this. And I thank him every day for it because I never would have done it without his help.
When did the depression start?
When I was a child.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So you were dealing with it your whole life?
My whole life. Oh, completely. So some of those years, like when I was dating Bill or when I would be moving, those were some of the worst years.
Because it was so stressful because you didn't have friends.
And because I was unmedicated then.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't start taking medication until about 3 years ago.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Wow. About 27.
Did you try other methods? You try 5-HTP?
I've tried some things. And I've been in therapy my whole life. My parents first put me in therapy when they first started to decide that they were thinking about getting a divorce. And I was young then. I was maybe 6 or 7. So from the time I remember, I've understood the therapeutic process. And they always really promoted that in me. So then even after the divorce and the remarriages and all of that, I started doing the therapy thing on my own. Then when I went to college and I was very much on my own. I went to college when I was 16, by the way, and lived on my own at 16. I was fucking weird kid. Yeah. So I was a little, I'm an adult, but I wasn't. I did that. I went to therapy. I did all those things by myself, but I always had this mental block. I always had this like, oh, I don't need meds. Meds means you're really crazy. Mm. Meds means you really don't have control. And not until I kind of hit a very bad rock bottom a few, maybe 3 years ago, did I finally say, you know what, fuck it. I think I actually have to do this. I think it would be good for me. And then it was the same experience that I've heard over and over and over from people where finally they get on the meds that are right for them and they calibrate to their dosage and maybe they've been on it for about 2 months and they just have this epiphany of like, why the fuck did I wait so long? Mm. I could have felt like this my whole life. What the fuck was I thinking? Because you're so societally, we're so resistant to looking at mental illness the same way we look at physical illness.
Mm.
It's so easy. Paul Gilmartin just made this point when he was on my podcast last week. If you went up to somebody with diabetes, type 1 diabetes, and you were like, what the fuck, dude? Why don't you just think more positively so that your pancreas makes more insulin? Like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you just make more insulin? It's like, they'd be like, what are you talking about? It's the same thing with depression.
Mm.
People put the onus on, like, they look at it like it's a disease of will, but it's not. It's a biological illness. And that's just very hard for people to understand. And so what you end up doing is carrying around a lot of guilt and shame and a lot of feelings like, I'm not good enough. I can't will myself out of this. If I just think more positively, it's not about that. And I did that for years. Years. You just deal with it. And I destroyed so many relationships.
Wow. Yeah. I can only imagine. I can only imagine being trapped in that scenario.
Yeah.
But I'm also very sensitive to the variables that different people go through with their bodies. I have hypothyroidism. I have to take thyroid medication. It runs in my family. My mother has it.
My mom has it too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know I used to get headaches. These weird headaches at the end of the day where I was like, oh, I'm so fucked. Like, I could fall asleep and it wasn't like I was like, now I get tired, I go to sleep. But it was like, I could fall asleep just watching TV and be out for like 8 hours. Like, it didn't make any sense. It was like a weird tired, like I was in pain. So, and I get these weird headaches. And then once I finally got on medication, it was like, whoa.
Night and day.
Yeah.
Right? You're like, oh, this is what other people feel like.
Right.
Like, I thought I was normal. Because that's another thing. There's such a stigma in this country, not just about mental illness, but about any sort of illness where people can't openly, freely talk about it. So you end up living in this weird bubble where you don't really, like, I know people that have mental illness that didn't even realize they had mental illness until they finally had a conversation with a doctor about it. And they were like, oh, this isn't normal.
Mm.
Like, not everybody doesn't hear voices or everybody doesn't. It's like, yeah, because you're so afraid to talk to somebody about it. So that's a really important part of this, I think, is just getting past the stigma. That's why when something like this with Robin Williams, which is so fucking depressing, happens, a lot of people rally around it and they say, hey, maybe we can use this as a teaching moment, because this guy, no matter how good his life was, he had this thing that he ultimately couldn't kick, and it wasn't his fault. It just is that way sometimes.
Mm.
And hey, maybe you have it too. I think in some ways it's good when high-functioning people come out and talk about their illnesses, because then people who are actually experiencing things like loss of employment, loss of a loved one, whatever, or who have had a bad go of it for other reasons are like, even you? Like you had said before, like, even you? but you're pretty, or but you're successful, you're whatever. Well, if you could have that, then of course it's not weird that I have, you know? It's like, it's a good thing for people to be able to see that they're not alone like that.
Yeah. And it's also, there's a bunch of people that attribute other people's depression really irresponsibly to a bunch of different things.
They'll
say, like, oh, I had a guy on the podcast last week that was saying that Robin Williams killed himself because his ex-wives took all his money.
As if he knows it all, anything about it. Yeah, I'm so glad you're such an expert on that.
He was saying that it was a women's addiction to free stuff that was caught. It was so...
That's horrible. And it makes you want to be like, who the fuck are you to presume that you know what's happening in somebody else's head, ever?
Well, not only that, it's insanely irresponsible to go against the grain of science and medicine, which is clearly established that it's an illness.
There's an illness. Yeah. And I think that that's something, too, that a lot of people don't understand. The same way we're so comfortable with concepts of diagnosis and cure because we're so used to things like flu, cold, tonsil infection, whatever, where you take an antibiotic or you take an antiviral or you just wait and your immune system clears the disease. We're used to catching things and then eliminating them. But when you have disease states that are process states like cancer, like diabetes, like mental illness, there's no cure per se. Like I got a tweet just earlier today from somebody who was like, blah, blah, blah. Have you ever thought about blah, blah, blah to cure your depression? It's like, I'm not cured of depression because I take citalopram. I'm in treatment.
That's fascinating.
I'll be in treatment the rest of my life.
Do you believe, as a person who's a neuroscientist, is it possible that they could eventually come up with something that balances your brain out instead of just adding something to your neurochemistry, which sort of enhances your serotonin levels, but rather something that where they can get it at a genetic level?
I hope so. I mean, I really hope so. We're starting to see major improvements in cancer biology with personal genomic medicine. My fear with genomic medicine is only, not to put a dark cloud on it because I think that it has amazing prospects. My fear is that it's going to further increase the kind of class divide where you've got people who are sick because sickness strikes rich and poor the same. But for some reason, we are a very class-based system. And I think that you're going to see that rich people get those kinds of treatments and poor people don't. And that kind of scares me.
Isn't that how it always is with anything emerging technologies? Yeah. Remember in the old days, the Wall Street phone? Remember that Wall Street movie where Michael Douglas had that big fucking stupid phone? And that was like a huge status symbol.
Yeah.
Rappers used to have in videos. Most people couldn't afford a phone.
Yeah.
Now I go to Brazil all the time for the UFC and I've gone to these poor neighborhoods. You see people on cell phones.
Oh, you see it in African nations where there isn't enough malaria medication. But I mean, there's this huge malaria push right now to increase awareness. And, you know, you can get mosquito nets, you can do malaria tests on your family, and you do it all through your cell phone because it's very common for people to have cell service or maybe not service, but to have access to a cell phone because the technology is getting cheaper and cheaper. So, yes, I do think that time always tells. And that hopefully eventually that kind of stuff trickles down. But I wish it didn't have to trickle down. Mm. I wish medication, I wish health and wellness were a more egalitarian enterprise. That one of the biggest problems, I think, with the structure of American government and being such a capitalist society, which I'm all about capitalism, don't get me wrong. I think we need to be a socialist capitalist blend just like we are. We have a lot of socialist systems in our country. The mail is socialist. Public education is socialist. We have a lot of capitalist systems in this country. I hate that healthcare is a for-profit system in America. It makes no sense to me.
The argument is obviously that people who work harder, are more ambitious, become better at it, should be rewarded for that, and that's what's going to motivate them to work harder and be the best heart surgeon, to be the best brain doctor, to be the best, you know, guy who fixes bones.
I just feel like by the time you're a brain surgeon and you're a licensed brain surgeon, you're a fucking good brain surgeon. Like you don't get through a 10-year residency. You get your surgical degree and then you have a 10-year residency before you become a neurosurgeon. You don't get through that and you're like a subpar neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. You're a fucking incredible neurosurgeon.
But aren't there the best of the best?
Like, of course there's the best of the best. And if those people want to do private practice on top of it, that's fine.
But private practice on top of the socialized medicine?
Yeah, there has to be a National Health Service. There has to be.
I agree with that.
Here's the problem. Here's the problem. Fundamentally, and if you can provide me an argument that solves this problem for a capitalist healthcare system, then I'm all about to, and I don't mean you, but I mean anybody listening, I'm all about hearing it. The problem is that when you have a capitalist system that's a competition-based system for profit, what ends up happening is that people compete. That's how it works, right? You compete. And a lot of times they say that's what drives prices down, is that you compete and prices get better and then the best, whatever. But what ends up happening when you have for-profit healthcare is that illness is incentivized. Wellness is not. People make more money the sicker you get. People make more money the more procedures you have to get. People make more money the longer you stay in the hospital. And the minute, I'm not saying there's some grand conspiracy to keep people sick, but if you've got an industry like the insurance and pharmaceutical and for-profit hospital industry, where the profit comes from sickness, where is the incentive to get people well? I'm not saying that doctors aren't very noble people. They are, and they work every day, doctors, nurses, other healthcare officials, to get people better. But the system itself does not incentivize wellness. It incentivizes sickness. So at that very basic level, it's a bit broken, because somewhere along that chain, people are going to take advantage. They're going to say, oh, I make more money if this guy has to stay in the hospital an extra day, or I make more money if this guy has to get this quote unquote unnecessary procedure. All the way across the board, the sicker you are, the more money goes into the system. And that's really gross. It's gross. There are certain things that capitalism don't work on. And I think that wellness, which is a basic human right, is one of those things. It just doesn't make sense. It's fundamentally incompatible with that type of monetary system.
But isn't that just taking into account only people that do the wrong thing?
Yeah.
I mean, but people who do the right thing, who motivate themselves to become the best orthopedic surgeon and treat the Lakers and fix all their knee issues, and these people rise to the occasion, shouldn't they be rewarded?
Totally.
For that?
And the turd in the pool is not the surgeon. Trust right. me. It's the insurance company. It's the pharmaceutical company.
It's occasionally the surgeon. I have a friend who, when he was young, my friend Aubrey, when he was young, worked at a resort, and he clearly remembers these doctors bragging about how they talked some guy into getting a surgery, and because of that, he's buying a Porsche.
Yeah. No, there is that. Oh, for sure. So the fact that it even trickles down to the people who took a Hippocratic oath, to mm-hmm. the people who we think of as being the most noble of the most noble of citizens in this country, if it even trickles down to them, how is it going to affect somebody who's pushing paper at the insurance company, where you're just a number on a piece of paper, you're just a statistic,
right.
and you're a bottom line, you're not
so
a real
person?
So
is the answer to cut out that aspect of it, that the insurance company is the issue, and that really socialized medicine would be compensating the doctors, and that the doctors would still be potentially able to rise above the others?
That would be my answer, is the same, I think, as any other industrialized Western nation. We're the only industrialized Western nation that doesn't have national health care. So what ends up happening is you have a public option. You have the option to have a health care system that is free and available to you, and it has basic levels of treatment and care for anything that could go wrong with you. And there are doctors you can see, and there are hospitals you can go to. If you want to go private, it's the same way that we have education in this country. I had an amazing public education. I have friends who went to private school. Their parents wanted them to go to private school. Good for them. They may have had a better education than me. They may not have, because there were still amazing teachers available and an incredible infrastructure in place for me to get an incredible education as
if
a public student.
If you get lucky and in the right spot, or you can be in the LA Unified School System and have fucking horrible education.
And that is a problem with gentrification and with segregation and with, again, I think, some of the problems of our capitalist society.
Well, it's certainly a problem in how we view and what we think about in terms of where our money should go. Like if we had privatized police force and privatized fire, like every time your house was on fire, you had to pay someone to come and fix the issue and put the fire out. Like, my God.
It's happened before. It's happened. Yeah, you can find stories online of people living in regions where they have, like, a privatized fire service. Like, it's a for-pay fire service, and, like, people's houses have burned down because they can't afford to put it out.
A weird area, like some rural area.
Yeah. Exactly.
But imagine if that was an urban issue. It is with healthcare. I mean, healthcare, you could be in the biggest, most populated city in the world, and there's poor people that don't have healthcare.
Yeah.
I think that if society is going to offer basic services, police force, fire, for you know, fire departments, medicine has got to be one of them.
It's got to be one of them. And the thing is, when you put the kind of money into preventive care that's necessary, you end up saving so much money on the back end. When people who can't afford to go to the doctor until they have a festering wound or until they've allowed the cancer to spread or whatever are going to the doctor early on and they're getting a checkup because they can afford it, because it's free to them. When you've got somebody who's living on the street, who's obviously going to be subject to much more infection, much more disease, because they're living in squalor. If they can go to the doctor on a regular basis and get a checkup, they're not going to be then going to the doctor later to get some multi-$1,000 procedure that Hippocratic Oath, they have to do this. If somebody goes into and their like fucking arm is hanging off, no doctor is going to be like, I can't reattach your arm, you're just going to die. They're going to do it. They're going to bill these people and they're never going to fucking pay their bills because they can't afford to. And then you and I are going to absorb that cost in the money that we're paying for our insurance.
Well, doesn't that go back when you're talking about people living in squalor? That goes back to the mental illness issue as well. Because
hugely.
That's a massive percent of those people that are wandering around homeless. They're
such an important point to make.
Well, that was the goddamn Ronald Reagan administration. They changed the standards. They let loose. I remember it. Yep. I was a kid and I remember being in New York and seeing all these fucking people wandering. I came to New York for a martial arts tournament during the Reagan administration. And I remember like people were talking, you know, I was young, I was a teenager, and these adults were talking about these, that all of a sudden they changed the mental health standards and they were releasing all these people. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, they're just releasing them? They were taking these people that were in mental institutions, and they changed the standards of what you needed to keep these people in these facilities, and they were just releasing them on the streets. And
there was
this influx.
There were two massive releases. There was one in the 50s when Haldol first came on the market, which is an antipsychotic, which was a major improvement in psychiatric care. So all of a sudden, you had people who were schizophrenic, who had delusional kind of disorders, and you could treat them. And so these people who were like basically just being fed and watered in asylums were given Haldol and they could lead functional lives again. So there you saw a big change in the way that mental health services happened. You no longer had the asylum population, and then you started having more this idea of like a mental health facility. And then again, during the Reagan administration, you saw a big release. The problem there was it was really a name only. They weren't getting any better treatment. They were just put out on the street.
They just changed the standard.
Exactly. And so you've got these people that are put out on the street. And it's again, there's, don't get me wrong, I mean, look at me. Like I said, I moved out when I was fucking 16. I busted my ass my whole life to like work really hard. I got a good education. Even coming to LA with Bill, he opened a bunch of doors for me. I fucking walked through those doors. I made sure that I was as responsible as possible. I am all about fiscal and personal responsibility. I have amazing credit. I have no debt. But I also know that as a nation, we're only as strong as the weakest amongst us. And there are certain people to whom those types of standards just can't apply because they're ill.
Well, it's a spectrum issue, isn't it?
I mean,
there's so many variables that when people like to look at these issues and look at them in a black and white term, I'm a liberal, so I think this. I'm a conservative, so I think that. And that's really, I have a lot of ideas that are very liberal and a lot of ideas that are fairly conservative.
Me too,
There's real issues with picking a side like that, especially when it comes to ideologies.
It's just such a lazy way to think.
It's
you're not thinking. You're letting somebody else think for you.
Yeah.
I get a lot of hate when I come on your podcast, but also when I go on the Young Turks. Anytime I talk about GM foods or genetically modified crops in any way, and because what ends up happening is people look at me and they go, "Oh, you're a liberal.
You're a shill."
They say I'm a shill because they look at me and they say, "Okay, you're a liberal. You're a progressive. You're left wing. Why do you have this super conservative conservative ideology when it comes to GM foods, why would you say that you think that's a good thing? You must be pro big agribusiness. You must be pro Monsanto. And it's like, because I don't inform my politics based on what a party tells me. My politics are informed based on the science. I study the science behind genetic modification, and I come to a personal conclusion that genetic modification in and of itself is not only not dangerous, but can also be a huge boon. It can be really helpful for health and human safety across, especially in lower income and globalized areas where they're not very industrialized. The second problem is that people have a really hard time with the concept of synecdoche, this idea of, you know, that's a literary term for like looking at the part for the whole or the whole for the part. So people say GM food, Monsanto.
Right.
Oh, Monsanto, it's the same thing. It's not the fucking same thing. That's a company that utilizes GM technology. And yes, recently I got offered a branded entertainment job with Monsanto and I had to turn it down. And the reason I turned it down was not necessarily because I really disagree with the practices, even though I do fucking disagree with their practices. Like, let's be honest, there are a lot of Monsanto things that make me mad.
The social practices are evil.
But, well, and the capitalist kind of practice. Yeah. But the reason I had to turn down this brand deal is because I knew that if I ever took a dime from a company like Monsanto, my ability as a journalist to talk about GM crops from a very neutral perspective would be out the window. Nobody would ever take me seriously again. So it's the same thing with Big Pharma. People go like, oh, Big Pharma's evil. And it's like, so what, should you never take drugs again? Are you out of your fucking mind? It's like, you've got to be able to look at these things in a nuanced way and understand that there are problems and there are evils, but you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And you can't say, oh, all modern medicine is terrible because Pfizer is making money on the backs of poor people. It's like, yeah, that's fucked up about Pfizer, but that doesn't mean modern medicine is terrible. Those are two totally different conversations.
It's also people, when they start talking about genetically modified foods, one of the things that they have to take into consideration is that almost everything you eat is genetically modified.
Oh, yeah.
When you go to the grocery store, if you're getting corn, if you're getting apples, if you're getting tomatoes, stop thinking that this just because it's organic, that it's not genetically modified. The corn that you eat today has no resemblance to the original corn.
None whatsoever. And then they'll say, yeah, but it might not be transgenic. It likely is transgenic too. And that's another thing. Like, genetic modification is a really big umbrella term.
Right.
It could be selective breeding is genetic modification.
Exactly.
A lot of people have a hard time with the concept of transgenic foods. And I say to them, fine. If you don't want to eat transgenic foods, good.
Define transgenic.
So transgenic foods would be actually a scientist going into the genome of an organism. Let's say it's a type of corn. They go into the genome and they go, okay, this corn tends to die readily when the temperature gets above 101. Well, the climate is changing. It's getting hotter and hotter where they farm it. So we're going to tinker with the genome and we're going to delete a gene or insert a gene or move the genes around in some way so that this corn is now drought resistant. Change the genome, produce a new corn crop, and then continue to breed that corn crop. And that is really the goal and generally the motivation behind GM crops. It's to make them withstand things like droughts or pests or whatever so that they can live hardier and feed more people in that way. Now, sometimes you have a company like Monsanto doing their own research where they want to make a crop that can only live for one generation and then die so that farmers have to keep buying their seeds, for example, or they make a Roundup Ready crop. I want a crop so that I can spray the whole thing down with Roundup. The crop survives, but all of the weeds around it die. It's an easier way to farm, but it could have some really detrimental ecological effects. But for the most part, this is why a lot of scientists get pissed off about all the GM hysteria, because they're like, okay, if I were to take this random corn crop and that random corn crop and breed them, I'm shuffling like 30,000 genes. If I were to go in targeted and change three genes that only affect the ability for it to withstand a higher temperature, it's a much more specific and targeted way to change this plant. I trust it more. I know exactly what I'm eating. But people are like, ah, it's horrifying because you're going in with, you know, pipetters and tools.
Well, it's because of things like Roundup, because of companies that do. I mean, there's a reason why people are suspicious. There's a reason why people are cautious.
Totally.
It's because they are worried about. And then there's been also some fuckery involved in these studies too. Like, there's a study about rats where they showed they grew all these tumors, but it turned out that the rats that they used were more susceptible to tumors in the first place.
It's not, it's, you know what, as somebody, as a person who has never studied lab science, to try and make sense of all the bullshit in the media and to be reading articles that were written by journalists who have never studied lab science, how are you expected to keep things straight? That's why I do what I do for a living. I'm a science communicator, and my job is to look at research that exists and to try and translate that to the public. But I also want to try and understand where the public is coming from. Why are you afraid of this thing? Why does this thing worry you? Let's understand the psychological reasons behind it. Let's understand what you've been fed your whole lives by the media and see what's reasonable and what's not, and come to a rational conclusion about it. Unfortunately, we as a species respond better in some ways to fear and hysteria. We see something on the news that's like, holy shit, this thing could kill you. And you're like, oh my God, really? I need to know about this. Because if the media was always presenting things rationally, like, okay, let's take a balanced approach to this. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the pros and the cons. And people would tune out. It's not that interesting anymore. The things that we find salient are the things that raise the hairs on the backs of our necks. And what that ends up breeding is, you know, is just a media landscape of fear mongering and screaming matches and worst case scenario conversations, which I don't think is very helpful for anybody.
It's also the reality of the absorption of information, the people's ability to take in how much time do you have in a day?
Exactly.
Most people work 8+ hours a day, plus commuting, plus family, plus
and they
whatever
have to be an expert about whatever they do for a living.
And
I don't, you know,
contradicting information. You could always go online and find a host of websites that will tell you about the evils of genetically modified foods.
Easily.
And if you absorb that information and that is what you preach. That's your mantra now. It's very difficult to be open-minded and then sort of accept other ideas and that contradict those original ideas
completely
that you've been telling everybody about.
And the truth is, it's hard to figure out who to trust, especially in a landscape like this. That's why I never promote. I have no intention as a science communicator that the work that I do is going to necessarily promote a lot of people to go off and become scientists themselves. I mean, hopefully young children or some teens, people who are in that age group and who are interested, maybe they'll be influenced a little bit about some of the work that I do. But more than that, I want to see a higher level of scientific literacy in this country. All that means is that we think more with our brains and less with our emotions and less with our gut, you know, that Stephen Colbert truthiness. Like, we got to get away from truthiness. Just because something feels right doesn't necessarily mean that it is right. So it's like, stop for a minute, listen to the argument that's being made. Who is making the argument? Do they have any financial reason to be making the argument? Do they have any political reason to be making the argument? Is this article about GMOs being evil on a website called ohmygodgmosareevil.com? or is it like
someone
a legitimate
needs to start
news
that website right now?
and that's the thing. Yeah. And I think this also goes back to this conversation I had about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. The mainstream media has its problems, but journalism as an enterprise has a lot of nobility to it. The pharmaceutical company has major problems and it's very broken. The insurance company too. But medicine has so much worth to it, especially, you know, evidence-based biomedical advances. Psychiatric medicine has a lot of, you know, pluses. The process of genetic modification is so important. But yes, Monsanto has a lot of problems. We've got to be able to think more nuanced about these things. And instead of going, well, I don't trust Fox News, therefore I don't trust any media, therefore I only am going to go to the site that keeps, as you said, reinforcing what I already believe, OMG, GMOs are horrible.com. That's the only place where I get my news. Well, now you're in an echo chamber.
Yeah. That's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you brought up there about political, about financial, all the different motivations, all the different things and the variables, that's also stuff that you have to try to pay attention to and squeeze into your head. And that's the thing
that
people, it's impossible. We need someone like you to sort of break it down, someone who has a background in this particular area, to break it down in a way that we can understand. We go, okay, I'm comfortable that Cara Santa Maria is being honest with me about this particular aspect of depression and neurochemistry. Mm. This is her experience. This is also what she knows about the science behind it.
Because I have no motivation otherwise. Nobody's paying me to say this. And I think that this is why we, as, you know, the listeners of the Joe Rogan Experience, the listeners of Talk Nerdy with Kara Santa Maria, the people who are really involved in the next movement of alternative and new media, it is our responsibility to continue to support these kinds of programs and to continue to speak up and become engaged and involved. Because if we're not happy with the way that traditional media is handling things because they're playing to the ratings and they're playing to the lowest common denominator, we can't be passive about it. We have to support the news outlets and the organizations and the podcasts and the web shows that we support. We have to do our part to make sure that those things don't fail, because the unfortunate thing is we don't have the backers that they have. You know, I have Squarespace on my side. I have Computer Learning Zone on my side. You have these wonderful sponsors on your side that help you keep doing this so that you can offer it for free to your listeners. But we're not being backed by Pfizer.
But we don't have to be. We're also doing it with these other companies that find value in it. And they know that we're going to say some crazy shit.
But the only reason they're going to keep supporting us is if people keep listening.
But the only reason why people are going to keep listening is because it's interesting. And the only reason why it's interesting is because we're being honest.
Yes. And so that whole chain, like, we're all in it together. I think that's the important thing, is that, like,
I agree.
We're here for you. You're here for us. And we're all on that kind of same team to be that counterculture and to offer opinions, but also offer facts that are based in evidence, that are based in reason, that aren't based in some sort of corporate interest or because some producer is in that fucking thing in my ear telling me that I have to do or say or act like somebody that I'm not.
I would love to talk to you about this to the end of time. And I would love to not tell you that you're already past the time you're supposed to leave.
You know what's so funny too, is the reason I have to leave, and I'm so sorry, you guys, is because I have therapy at 3, and I've got to make it all the way across town to see my therapist.
Listen, anytime you want to do this, I'm more than happy.
I love it.
I love doing it with you, and I'm so happy you're doing your show.
Thank you so much for wearing my t-shirt. Awful. I have to, can I take a moment to plug? Is that okay?
Please.
Because I just started making all this great merchandise, and if you go, Brian, to my main website, just to care, like if you go home, maybe, okay. Click on home, then you can see that I've got all of my episodes right there. You can download them.
What's
you can
with the dinosaur?
That was on a different page. It was an old episode that I did of Talk Nerdy to Me. But there's, you know, you can see my episodes of the podcast right there. I use SoundCloud, so it's through there. And then if you scroll down, you can see all of my merchandise there. I have t-shirts and stickers and slap bracelets.
Just like this one.
Just like that one.
Sexy old school microphone.
Right? Yeah, I'm going to have a new style coming out soon. And also I'm going to be offering soon handmade mugs from a really amazing Potter friend of mine.
Oh, wow.
So those will be
cool.
Really cool, custom one-of-a-kind mugs.
Mine are made in a fucking factory in China by slaves.
But they're beautiful.
They are pretty cool. Well, it's Mike Maxwell. Mike Maxwell, the artist.
I really like it. It's cool. And I get to take this home, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, fuck yeah.
Sweet.
We have Run JRE cups now, too. And awesome. If you guys want to buy them, they're available at higherprimate.com. Thank you very much, Kara.
Thank you.
You're fucking awesome. Your podcast is awesome. I always love talking to you. It's always just trying to catch up with your thought process.
Yay.
And stuff it all in there, but I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please check out her podcast. It's amazing.
And tweet me, guys. Tweet me, @Kara Santa
Maria. Tweet the shit out of her. Anything else before we go? You got anything going on?
New t-shirts.
You just fucking talked to the back of a microphone, son.
4 new t-shirts at shopsquad.tv. And
beautiful.
Come into Columbus, Ohio with Tony and Tiffany Haddish.
All that information is on deskquad.tv. Go there, check it out. And thank you to our sponsors. Thank you today to ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan, and you can post jobs for free. Give it a shot, ZipRecruiter.com. Thanks also to NatureBox. Go to naturebox.com/Rogan and get 50% off your first box. And thanks also to Onnit. Go to Onnit. Use the code word Rogan. Save 10% off any and all supplements. All right, you dirty fucks. We'll see you tomorrow. Big kiss. Mwah.
Mwah.